Walking While Female in Pakistan, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Here's what happens to many women in Pakistan when they head to the market and walk past the men.
So there are two kind of reactions you get in marketplaces. Either they like are leering at you and make you uncomfortable, or they don't look at you at all.
Plus, women in Iceland go on strike, leaving work 14% early to match the pay gap with Icelandic men.
After 5 hours and 38 minutes at work, we have done our part if we are going to get paid the same amount as men.
Also, the Cold War was scary, but at least everyone knew the rules back then.
Now, kind of Putin's torn up the rule book, and I think the West is struggling to work out what the rules are now.
Those stories ahead, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. The gender pay gap is one stubborn statistic. Even in countries at the forefront of the drive for women's equality, a man doing essentially the same job as a woman usually makes significantly more money. Take Iceland, for example. Women there earn 14 to 18% less than their male counterparts, and they're tired of working part of their day basically for free. So last Monday at exactly 2:38 p.m., or 14:38 as they say over there, thousands of women and the men who support them took a radical step.
Almost all women in Iceland walked out of their workplaces.
That's Birta Björnsdóttir of the Icelandic National Broadcasting Service. For her, taking part in the protest meant waiting for that moment and walking off live TV.
I looked at my watch, and when the time was 14:38, I handed the microphone over to my colleague and went downtown to protest.
So people watching saw you kind of walk off.
I wasn't not the only woman in Iceland that did that. Thousands of women, and of course some men as well, gathered both in Reykjavik but all around Iceland as well to protest this thing that still is going on in Iceland and all over the world, unfortunately. After 5 hours and 38 minutes at work, we have done our part if we are going to get paid the same amount as men.
So essentially you're offering work for free after 14:38 each day based on what the hourly wage would be for men.
Of course, it's not, you know, every woman, but, you know, in general, it's like that.
So in Iceland, female workers are essentially getting paid between 14 to 18% less than men.
In general, it's almost 30% less for similar jobs. That's the average.
How does that compare to across Europe?
You know, Iceland is pretty good at gender equality in many aspects, but this is, of course, something that needs to be fixed.
You mentioned gender equality, and of course, Iceland, as you said, is on the forefront. I mean, there's a new report from the World Economic Forum just out this week that rates Iceland number one in terms of gender equality. Isn't that good news for Iceland?
Of course it is. Of course it is. But that doesn't mean that we can't protest. And I think we also hope that this thing that we did on Monday is something that women in other countries might look to, like what happened in Iceland in 1975, when women first quit their jobs and marched out on the streets. That was about the same thing that we were protesting this week. And, you know, everyone is very positive about it. Employers were very positive in Iceland and, you know, all supporting it and almost everyone encouraging women to walk out at 14:38. But it's also, you know, frustrating that it was first done in 1975, like I said, and I wasn't even born then, but my grandmother and my mother were both there. And it's frustrating that 41 years later, we still get paid less.
What was the percentage disparity back in 1975 between men's and women's wages?
We have gone up a bit, a few percentages. It's coming, but it's happening rather slowly.
Where does the activism on women's part in Iceland come from? Is it built into the country, or did Icelandic women fight long and hard to even get this issue paid attention to?
Icelandic women have been in the front line. I mean, like you mentioned earlier, we are on top of lists that take together what the situation is in countries all around the world. We are, of course, a small nation, so it's rather easy to get everyone's attention through media and social media. And, you know, that's easy in Iceland because we are so few.
What about your daughter? I understand you have a 10-year-old daughter. What do you want her to learn from this?
I sincerely hope that she doesn't, in 10 years or so, have to march out on the street to still be protesting that she doesn't get paid as much as her co-workers. I was describing this to my children. I have a 7-year-old boy as well, and they couldn't understand it. Hopefully we are raising our children to stop this nonsense. I mean, they ask me so many questions about why is it like that. So that's a good thing, I think, and I hope that they will keep that in mind.
Björta Björnsdóttir is a TV journalist with the Icelandic National Broadcasting Service. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Coming up later on the show, an artist describes how women in Pakistan are routinely harassed while walking down the street. And we meet a young woman who's become the face of Pakistan's anti-drone campaign. Hashtag balance of power ahead on the world. We reported Monday on the dismantling of the jungle migrant camp in Calais, northern France. Calais is just across the English Channel from Britain. Thousands had been staying there, hoping for a chance to somehow slip into Britain. This week, the authorities moved most of the migrants to other locations in France, but a large number of unaccompanied teenagers and children remain. We reached Dorothy Tsang at the camp earlier. She's with Save the Children.
When I left last night, the Calais camp went up in flames yesterday in the afternoon. Really ferocious flames, and so everyone ran out. But actually what children found as they came out was that the accommodation, the container camps where minors are being housed were full. So children literally had nowhere to turn. And as I left in the evening, we had around 60 minors as young as 13 who had nowhere to sleep.
Where did they sleep? Did they stay there or were they taken somewhere else?
So volunteers and organizations like Save the Children spent long into the night trying to negotiate a space for them in the warehouse, which we know has beds in it, with the French authorities. They managed to get just a handful of children in, and the rest were left to sleep on the road outside. Some even went back into the jungle camp, which was really distressing, particularly we were sitting with three Eritrean boys, 13 and 14 years old. They were terrified about going back into the camp. I can't stress enough how dangerous the camp has been the last few days for children.
What are the dangers to these kids?
I mean, there's fires, so being on your own anywhere as a child is pretty frightening. But these kind of places are real hotbeds for people who want to exploit the vulnerable, like traffickers.
What is happening to these kids today? Where are they?
Well, today we got there and we were hoping that for these remaining children who had spent the night sleeping rough, that we would be able to find some alternative accommodation for them. And we were promised that, actually, and by the French authorities. It's now going on to nearly 7 o'clock here. It's starting to get dark. And we've been standing on a road for hours in the cold with these children and also some adults too, quite a lot of adults too, who didn't make the buses yesterday. And we're just slowly being pushed up the road by police vans and riot police. It's really, really cold here. Children are sitting down with blankets right around them. We just brought some blankets over. It's starting to get dark now, so really worried about what tonight's going to bring.
I've read about, you know, several thousand of people from the jungle being taken to various places to be processed for asylum. Why aren't these kids part of those groups?
Well, every single day now, so the eviction started on Monday, and every single day, the registration process for children has been really chaotic. They were put in with adults, I'm just having to interrupt. The police are moving down the street as I speak now towards where we are, and everyone's getting panicked and starting to get up to run.
Do you need to go?
I might have to call you back.
Tsang did have to go, but we managed to reach her again later. Dorothy, what's going to happen to these kids now?
Yeah, so that's really unclear at the moment. So we thought that they were going to be put on buses and taken to accommodation. That's what we were kind of promised. And we've been standing here for hours waiting. We don't know what's going to happen. We definitely don't want them to have another night sleeping rough. It's absolutely freezing and it's not safe for them to be sleeping out here on their own.
How are the kids' spirits? Are they kind of weary and depressed, or are they kind of rallying? How do they seem?
They're really tired and they're really cold and confused and scared.
We've been speaking with Dorothy Tsang from Save the Children. Dorothy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The U.S. will take in close to 70,000 refugees this year from across the globe. Being a refugee isn't easy, leaving behind friends, family, and often careers, too. For highly educated refugees like doctors, engineers, and lawyers, settling in the U.S. generally means starting over. But a program in Boise, Idaho, is helping refugees find jobs more suited to their backgrounds. The World's Jason Margolis has our story.
A decade ago, Marwan Sweydan was performing surgeries in Iraq. His family was working with coalition forces and became targets.
My dad get captured, kidnapped, tortured, and get killed.
Sweydan applied for refugee status and was later relocated to San Jose, California.
Being a refugee is not something you plan for. Like, you don't wake up in the mornings like, I'm going to go and be a refugee today. No, it's just happened. It was a cultural shock to me coming to the United States, and I didn't understand what's going on, and everything was like collapsing around me. My world was collapsing. So the first job and the only job I found at that time was selling hot dog in a hot dog tray in a mall, Santana on San Jose. It was a fun job, to be honest. I learned a lot.
I met the 37-year-old at a fundraiser for the group Global Talent Idaho, or GTI. Tara Wolfson co-founded the nonprofit 2 years ago when she was working with a refugee resettlement agency and often saw people's talent, education, and expertise not being used.
I just decided that I couldn't look in the mirror any longer if I knew that a doctor was mopping floors or an engineer was working on an assembly line, picking raw meat off of it.
She says refugee resettlement programs in the U.S. aren't designed to help people land professional jobs.
The goal of the refugee resettlement system is early self-sufficiency, and that is the first job you can get as quick as possible.
In 2 years, GTI has placed about 125 refugees and immigrants into higher-skilled work. On average, they're now earning $26,000 more. And all of those higher salaries have pumped about $1 million into the local economy. The GTI program helps refugees improve their English, polish their resumes, and do mock interviews. Gina Finley with GTI says many refugees simply don't know how to market themselves here.
Probably one of the most common mistakes out the gate of an interview is in the U.S. The most common first question is, so tell me about yourself. And oftentimes in other countries, that means tell me about you personally. Tell me about your family and how your family is.
Marwan Sweydan, the surgeon from Iraq, was making those mistakes before GTI honed his skills.
They make your experience into a good story that the employer will be interested to see you in person.
What were you doing wrong in your interviewing? I mean, you seem like a very nice, normal, sociable person.
Well, let me tell you something. I learned the term overqualified in the United States because you put everything in the resume.
Employers were understandably confused why a surgeon was applying to deliver pizzas. Once GTI stepped in, Sweydan got hired as an infection prevention specialist, keeping operating rooms clean. He's back in a hospital, but it's a long way from performing surgery.
So I think I'm using my experience, but not to full capacity.
Make decent money?
Oh, yeah. Now I'm making a good living. I actually purchased my first house here in the United States. Yeah.
But you'd be making better living as a surgeon.
Oh, definitely.
A few other cities also have programs like Global Talent Idaho. They can help highly skilled refugees get back on their feet, but not all the way back. Bill Kerr at Harvard's Business School says certain occupations come with barriers to entry.
So law and medicine are places that if you're coming to the United States from abroad, it can be very difficult to enter into some of those professions due to the bar exams and the licensing boards and all that come in with that. So occupational licensing can be quite common, even to become a hairdresser or a barber.
To become a licensed physician in the United States, Marwan Sweydan would need to study for and pass 3 highly rigorous and expensive board exams. Then he'd need to get accepted into a residency program competing against recent medical school graduates. If he works like mad and all goes smoothly, it could take him 4 to 5 years to get back to where he left off in Iraq, working as a doctor. He says, don't count him out.
I'll never let go of that dream, you know. I work hard for my degree in Iraq, and I'm going to work hard again, but eventually I'm going to make it.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Boise, Idaho.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. If you watch Russian TV news these days, you could easily believe the Cold War was back on. One recent story was titled, "Schizophrenics from America are sharpening nuclear weapons for Moscow." Another story declared, "This is the most dangerous time in history since the Cuban Missile Crisis." But it's not just the Russian media pushing this idea. The Russian government also carried out a massive 3-day civil defense exercise earlier this month with 40 million people preparing for a nuclear attack. And the Russian military just moved nuclear-capable missiles into the sensitive enclave of Kaliningrad. My BBC colleague Steve Rosenberg is in Moscow. So, Steve, everyone in Moscow is supposed to have access to a bomb shelter now. Do you know where yours is?
No, I have absolutely no idea where my local bomb shelter is or whether they'll let me in. And although you're absolutely right, the Russian authorities did say that 40 million people were involved in these exercises, I didn't actually see anyone myself who was taking part in an exercise. So I'm not sure if that figure is actually accurate. But certainly the authorities have been flexing their muscles. You mentioned the nuclear-capable Iskander missiles, which have been moved into Kaliningrad on Europe's doorstep, pointing west. The Russians have also sent another fleet of warships to the Mediterranean, to the conflict in Syria. They've decided to upgrade their small naval facility in Syria into a full-scale naval base. They've pulled out of three nuclear agreements recently with the United States, and they've just held military exercises with Egypt. So lots of examples here in the last couple of weeks of Russia sending, I think, a very strong message to the West, particularly to Washington, that Russia considers itself to be a global power which demands respect.
But what's really going on? Why now?
There's a number of reasons. Let's look at Syria, first of all. I think Russia is using this moment in time, the time that America is bound up in its domestic affairs with the upcoming election, use this moment to achieve military victories on the ground and give President Assad and Russia a stronger position in any future negotiation. But also, I think there's frustration in the Kremlin that Russia hasn't secured the respect it set out to achieve.
But how far is Putin willing to go? I mean, it's one thing to send messages and act big and tough, but what's at stake? How far is Russia willing to go with this?
You know, one thing I think is pretty clear. He's not a suicidal president. I don't think President Putin doesn't want a military confrontation with the United States. So I think he's using this moment in time to flex his muscles, believing that it's going to help him and help Russia to secure the respect he so desires. He may well be misguided because, judging by NATO's reaction, NATO bolstering its forces on Russia's doorstep. NATO this week announced plans to bolster its forces in the Baltic. Well, here, that is being interpreted as an aggressive step by NATO. So you have this spiral. NATO reacts to what it sees as Russian aggression. Russia reacts to what it sees as NATO aggression. And that is why I think when you speak to politicians here and political pundits, they say this is a very dangerous time.
All very disturbing. I don't
sound
of any of it.
It's difficult because, you know, it's hard to believe that Putin, Obama, Theresa May, anybody would want a military confrontation between East and West.
Yeah.
You'd like to believe that. But everything that's been going on the last couple of weeks suggests that things are slightly getting out of control and there don't seem to be the checks and balances that perhaps existed in the Cold War. You know, the Cold War was dangerous and the threat of nuclear annihilation hung over the world. But both sides realized that and there were kind of rules. But now kind of Putin's torn up the rule book. And I think the West is struggling to work out what the rules are now. And maybe the US election will be a watershed. I mean, Putin has just said that Russia will work with any president who's elected to solve any problem. So perhaps that is a signal that, you know, once the US election is out of the way, there could be a clean page and, you know, they'll try and sort things out. But at the moment, it does look quite tense.
The BBC's Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
Big news in the art world, or big little news maybe, New York's Museum of Modern Art has licensed the original set of 176 emojis. These tiny 12 by 12 pixel designs of smiley faces, hearts, cats, and whatever were created by a Japanese phone company back in 1999. MoMA says the emoji inclusion is part of its mission to, quote, display and collect the art and design of our time. Jennifer 8 Lee says this is a big deal for emojis. Lee is a member of the Unicode Emoji Subcommittee, and Unicode is the group that controls emoji standards so different phones can easily send them back and forth. Jennifer, why do you think this is such big news?
Well, obviously the Museum of Modern Art in New York is sort of the canon of what is considered art and design that is notable and worth preserving for the future. And so these emoji actually date back from the 1990s, even though the ones that we're most familiar with now, which are the Apple emoji, are the ones that have become very iconic, whether or not in movies or in commercials or just like in our own little advertisements. The fact that they're going back and kind of preserving the original conceptual set of emojis is a statement about how far and impactful the emoji have become in our everyday language.
So what will people see when they walk into MoMA when these go on display? How are they being displayed?
So they're going to be on display starting in December for about 3 months in the lobby, which is an incredibly high traffic area. So arguably, actually, they will be seen more than many of the exhibits that are in the upper floors. So they're going to take some of these original emoji, which are actually the 12 by 12 pixel emoji. So they're not going to look like the Apple emoji of our day.
These are 12 by 12 pixels. So are they tinier than the things we see on our iPhones?
Yeah. Today, I mean, you can blow them up visually as you know, big or little as you want. But in terms of the resolution, these are like microscopic by today's graphical standards. I mean, the fact that they were able to convey as much information as they could with using, you know, 12 by 12 pixels and only 6 colors is sort of a testament to the design abilities of the original team.
What do these emojis look like, these sort of original emojis?
So these original emoji have a very kind of 8-bit feel to them, you know, in the same way that, you know, when you go back and you look at sort of old video games, they have that very nostalgic, grainy quality to them. A lot of them, you know, can get quite sophisticated. There's like a martini glass that actually looks sort of, you know, recognizably like a martini glass. There are a lot that are related to weather.
Do you have a favorite?
They just look very, of the original emoji, I don't have a favorite. I think I don't actually know them well enough because they've mostly disappeared actually from public consumption, because the emoji that we know today through Apple is probably like 5 or 6 generations descended from the original Docomo emoji from the mid-90s.
What do you think people are going to get out of looking at them in a museum instead of on their phone?
Well, what's really interesting about these emoji is that you can't see them on your phone anymore because they are from a different era, a different phone, a different, completely different operating system. So in a way, for most people, this is the first time that they will ever see the original emoji.
Jennifer Aitley is a journalist, and she's a member of the Unicode Emoji Subcommittee. Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Thanks.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. All this week, our Across Women's Lives team has been reporting from Pakistan. It's part of a series we're calling Balance of Power, exploring the impact U.S. foreign policy has on women and girls around the globe. And in a country like Pakistan, that has to include a look at how American military strategy affects civilians. Since 2004, U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan have killed thousands of people, mostly militants, but also civilians. And one girl has been pushed into the spotlight to become the face of the anti-drone campaign in Pakistan. From Islamabad, The World's Carolyn Beeler has the story.
My name is Nabila Aizir. I live in Pakistan.
Nabila Ur Rahman is 12 years old, and she's become the keeper of her grandmother's story. 4 years ago, Nabila was tending animals in the yard near her grandmother, Momina Bibi, when she heard a drone flying overhead. A U.S. drone.
All of a sudden, I heard 2 shots, and then I saw my grandmother in pieces.
As the smoke cleared, Nabila realized her hand was bleeding. A relative bandaged it and took her to the hospital with several of her siblings and cousins.
That was the moment that we realized that we have been hit by a drone, and all these kids were hurt in the strike.
I met Nabila at a park in Islamabad to talk about that day at her family's home in North Waziristan, about 10 miles from the Afghan border. We brought her to Islamabad because it's not safe for Western journalists to go where she lives. We sat on the ground and she picked at the grass, rarely making eye contact. She says after the drone attack, she got mad.
I felt a lot of hate and anger towards the United States. I started asking myself, why are they shooting women and children?
Nabila is quiet, but well-spoken for a 12-year-old. She speaks to why Pakistanis hate the U.S. drone program, even though its aim is to root out extremists who kill many more civilians. And Nabila has been well-coached on her message. When I ask her what she'd like to tell the next U.S. president, her father nudges her, grabs a plastic bag from the ground, and hands her a laminated photo of her grandparents. She holds it up while she answers.
My message to the new president of America is to look at the picture of my grandmother. She did nothing wrong, and she was killed. The next president should stop this war and spend money on education instead. Try to win the heart of the world rather than bombing us, and then people won't be hurting you.
Since the attack, Nabila has been pushed forward as the public face of her cause. In 2013, she testified before a U.S. congressional committee with her father and older brother.
For the very first time, members of Congress heard from two reported survivors of a drone attack in Pakistan 1 year ago this week.
Abdullah Wasti's organization, Foundation for Fundamental Rights, sets up Nabila's media appearances.
Apart from going to the Congress, they've also visited Japan recently as part of another conference. They've been coming to Islamabad. They've given interviews to Al Jazeera and other international news agencies. So yes, they've been very cooperative and they've been very determined with regards to advocating.
In Pakistan, men are the heads of families, and women are only allowed to speak out if their male relatives let them. This is Nabila's father, Rafiq Ur Rahman.
It's totally against the cultural norms and the tradition of Pashtuns. They don't never bring their women in front of the camera, in front of the mics. But the only motivation he has got is that it might bring peace.
Gender rights advocate Rukshanda Naz says Nabila is one of a growing group of young Pakistani girls acting as spokespeople for their causes. That started after teenage education crusader Malala Yousafzai won a Nobel Prize and became an international icon.
Because Malala become one icon, there is a trend where the father or the male family member, publicly they started to promote their young girls. So this is the one of the trend, no doubt.
Many of these girls lobby for health care or education. Nabila talks about the effects of drone strikes, but over and over she returns to the hot topic these days, girls' education. Even if Nabila is being coached in her words, Naz says her task isn't easy.
I'm not negating her activism because she has some guts. But on the other side, the main driver is her father.
Nabila says she likes speaking up against drone strikes, and she's enjoyed her trips to Japan and the U.S. She especially liked the parks in Washington, D.C. Rukshanda Naz argues that even if a girl is being pushed into the spotlight, at least she's being seen and heard.
I'm taking this as a positive. If, as a strategy now, they are giving space to women, so I think women should occupy this space.
Occupying her space as an activist has made Nabila's life better. She recently moved with some of her siblings to the city of Peshawar, a day's drive away. A Japanese NGO is sponsoring her to go to school there. There aren't any schools for girls where she's from. After some dark days living in fear in North Waziristan after her grandmother's death, Nabila says life is better now.
Going to school in a different city really makes it easier to forget about these things.
Nabila's grandmother was a casualty of the U.S.-led war against Islamic militants. But sometimes tragedy leads to opportunity, and this time it did for Nabila. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Islamabad.
We have one more story today from our Across Women's Lives team in Pakistan. Producer Andrea Crossan met an artist there. Her work reflects an experience that women around the world can relate to, feeling objectified. Shazil Malik is a designer and illustrator living in Lahore. Like many women in Pakistan, Malik takes a few minutes each morning to decide what to wear, based on what she thinks will attract the least amount of unwanted male attention, like whistles, catcalls, and stares. Malik got so fed up, she drew an image that has become symbolic of Pakistani women who feel harassed in public spaces. It's a powerful illustration of a woman walking with her arms crossed over her chest. Her head is down. There are faces of men staring at her, making gestures, leering. Written across her body are the words, "Is my shirt not long enough?" In Pakistan, women dress modestly, usually with both arms and legs covered, and often with a headscarf as well. But Malik says even when she's wearing all those layers of clothing, she still gets harassed. And that is at the core of her illustration.
I would walk outside every day and go to my park, and it was just getting very uncomfortable to be in that public space. And this image was basically exactly how I was feeling at the time. Like, I would worry about what I was looking like. I was worrying about other people. And I was like, I don't know if others are realizing the impact they're having on my internal, like, situation just going for a walk. And in Pakistan, public spaces are interesting because they're incredibly gendered. Like, my foreign friends came and they were like, Shazil, there's, like, there are no women in the street. Where are they? And I was like, no, there are actually a lot of women in the street. You're just not going to that street. For instance, we have Liberty Market, which is very woman-heavy. It's got all the cloth merchants and jewelry, and most of the footfall is women, and we feel very comfortable going there. I mean, yes, the men there may stare at you, but the shopkeepers definitely have a different energy because now you are the one buying. So they react very differently to you, as opposed to there's another road, Brandeth Road. I went to buy some hardware with my father. And as I was asking questions, I could see that the guy would not answer me. And later my dad was just laughing. He's like, isn't it funny how you didn't get an answer out of that guy? And I was like, no, it's not funny. What was happening is that he basically reduced me to my gender and thought it was respectful to not talk to me. So there are two kind of reactions you get in marketplaces. Either they like are leering at you and make you uncomfortable, or they don't look at you at all. When you step out and you get stared at a lot, and I think men here, what they do is, I think probably in the States, they'd be like, hey, baby, how's it going? Over here, they start singing under their breath, like Bollywood songs. Or they'll like start whistling inappropriately. And you just wonder, like, did I incite this? And I often get this, like I wear jeans a lot and I also pray. So it'd be like, oh, you don't look like somebody who prays. And that's ridiculous to me. Like, why is denim un-Islamic? Like, how is that a thing? I live with my parents and they very much dictate how many layers of clothing I should be wearing. And I had this conversation with my mom where I was like, at what age? And I'm really old now, like I'm like 3 decades have gone by on this earth. And I was like, at what age will you actually be okay with me walking out dressed the way I want to dress? And she thought about it, and then I was like, no, like I want a number. Like, you give me an age. And she's like, and she laughed and she was like, never. Seeing a woman outside should be normal. Seeing whether you're in jeans or a kurta or whatever should be fine. It shouldn't matter. But the fact that it does means that this conversation needs to happen.
That was Lahore resident and artist Shazil Malik. You can see her illustration of a woman with arms crossed asking, is my shirt not long enough? That's up right now at PRI.org. Mexico did it, so did France, Chile, and Hungary. And now the World Health Organization wants everyone else to do it, too. It wants more countries to put a tax on soda and other sugary drinks. Here in the U.S., it's starting to happen, but only at the local level. Philadelphia and Berkeley, California are taxing soda, and on November 8th, 3 cities in Northern California will vote on a soda tax. The beverage industry is putting up a big fight, and it's enlisted immigrant grocers as some of the most visible opponents to the tax. Bridget Huber has the story.
People in the Bay Area have been hearing lots of ads like these.
The last thing we need in Oakland is a tax on groceries.
They feature neighborhood grocery stores, an African food mart, a halal butcher shop, an Asian market. They show smiling customers and rows of fresh produce. The grocers warn about a tax proposal that would raise the price of groceries and hurt the community.
Va a ser algo muy terrible para la gente.
Their message is clear.
Please say no to the grocery tax.
That's where the clarity ends, because if you look at the ballots in San Francisco, Oakland, and Albany, you won't find mention of a grocery tax. What you will find is a soda tax, a penny per ounce excise tax on sugary drinks. The ads are bankrolled by the American Beverage Association. They say the soda tax is really a grocery tax because it's written in a way that would let store owners spread the extra cost to different products, not just soda. Community organizer Monica Gomez works with the pro-tax campaign in San Francisco. She takes issue with both the anti-tax message and the messenger.
This is our wall of shame.
At campaign headquarters, one wall is covered with ads and mailers funded by the soda industry. Gomez points to a picture of a man standing outside a market.
He looks like someone who could be from the Latino community who owns a business.
There are images of grocers and restaurateurs, all with something in common.
There's nobody who is white. And it's all targeted towards people of color and low-income communities. And so it's kind of like, why are they doing this?
It's especially galling to Gomez and other soda tax supporters, since diabetes rates among Latinos and African Americans are higher than average. Gomez, who was born in Mexico, says her mother and grandmother both have diabetes. The soda industry has spent more than $24 million fighting the proposed soda taxes in the Bay Area this year, almost twice as much as its opponents. And it's making headway. KKM Membo owns Oakland's African Caribbean food market and has appeared in anti-tax ads. She's standing at the register when a meter maid sticks her head in the door.
Well, you look pretty on TV.
I'm like, oh my God.
That's your girl.
I'm like, that's her.
The woman tells her she's voting no on the soda tax.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
See you.
Amembo says she already feels squeezed by the cost of doing business in Oakland, and a new tax won't help. Her customers are very sensitive to price.
If a drink is $1.99 and they come in and it's $2.25, they're going to notice.
And they may well go elsewhere. So instead of jacking up the price on soda, Amembo says she would spread the tax around to other items. Adel Al-Ghazali, a Yemeni grocer whose family owns Mi Tierra Market in San Francisco, says the penny per ounce tax sounds small, but it adds up.
You know, I talked to my client, and most of them not happy about it. We're already struggling as is.
He says it's not so much that he's taking the side of industry, but of his customers. Public health advocates say he's not doing his customers any favors. People who regularly consume sugary drinks are at higher risk for diabetes and heart disease. Berkeley's soda tax took effect in the spring of 2015, and UC Berkeley researchers have been tracking the results. So far, consumption of sugary drinks has dropped by 21%. And preliminary data show that overall, grocers have raised soda prices, but they haven't raised prices on other groceries. As Election Day nears, both sides are racing to sell voters on their version of what the tax would mean.
You know, Eva?
At the Oakland versus Big Soda campaign office, Claudia Rodriguez Briones is working the phones.
Hola, señora. Buenas tardes. Mi nombre es Claudia.
She works for a clinic that serves mostly Latino immigrants. When the pro-soda tax campaign asked the clinic for an endorsement, Rodriguez Briones wasn't sold. She didn't feel comfortable promoting a tax on groceries. But then she did more research.
And I got to read more about it. I understood that it was just a scam, that they were trying to convince you differently. And of course, if you see a grocery tax, you immediately think about your budget. Oh my God, I'm going to go to the store and pay more for all my groceries, even if I don't buy sugary drinks.
Rodriguez Briones says she felt like she was tricked. Tonight, she hopes to set the record straight. For The World, Bridget Huber, Oakland, California.
Bridget's story was produced in collaboration with the Food and Environment Reporting Network. I'm Carol Hills, and it's The World. In a moment, a new look at the life of Edvard Munch. You know, The Scream. But first, we have this essay from our friend Deepak Singh. He's an Indian-American writer who's lived in Virginia and Michigan, and now he has a new home.
I recently moved to Brunswick, Maine. And when I tell folks where I live now, they say, oh, lucky you, Maine is gorgeous. It is, and people are very friendly. But walking around downtown, I seem to be the only brown person here. A couple of days ago, though, I saw another man with brown skin. He had a flowing gray beard and a blue turban on his head. He looked like my Sikh neighbor in my hometown of Lucknow, in India. But the context was all wrong. As he came close, he looked at me and smiled. I smiled back and said something like, "You? Here? How?" He kept smiling, but didn't say anything. I thought maybe he didn't speak English. I switched to Hindi, and I asked him what he was doing in Brunswick, Maine. He replied in Punjabi, which I barely understand. I picked out a few words here and there. I gathered he was from the state of Punjab in India, and his son was in Boston. I got curious about his story and wanted to know more, but we couldn't communicate. Although he and I were from the same country, we had no language in common. We spent several minutes gesticulating and trying to talk. We laughed at how ridiculous it was that we had so much in common, but couldn't have a conversation. India has dozens of languages, and I've met people from different parts of the country, here in the US. I've always been able to find a shared language, but not this time. In the end, just before going our separate ways, I took out my phone and asked the Sikh gentleman to put his number in it. He keyed in the numbers and then his name. We both looked at our phones and burst out laughing. Our last names were same too, Singh. I promised to call him soon, but then I thought, how was I going to communicate? I figured we would find some way.
Writer Deepak Singh in Brunswick, Maine. Finally today, you know The Scream by Edvard Munch. It's one of the most iconic paintings ever. The image is widely produced on t-shirts, mugs, posters. It's even become a gesture. Put a hand on each cheek. Open your mouth, eyes and mouth really wide. Munch is a favorite son in Norway, and a bigger, better Munch museum is in the works to replace the existing one in Oslo. Stefan Kverneland is a Norwegian comic artist and a lifelong Munch fan. He spent 7 years researching and drawing a graphic biography of Munch.
He started out as an impressionist or a realist painter, really, but later on he started to get more and more radical under the influence of Van Gogh and Gauguin. He started to develop on his own a quite unique style that really was really important for the expressionists, the German expressionists. So he became sort of their leading star. And later he started to like their work as well. So I guess he's considered the first true expressionist.
That's kind of a key word here because his paintings are really about expressions and emotions and feeling. He said, "I do not paint what I see, but what I saw." What does he mean by that?
That's actually quite literal. It means that he's painting his memories. So it's very autobiographical. That's why it's so convenient to use his works in this comic biography, because they are actually scenes from his life. Edvard Munch himself, that's unique. He insisted on himself. He said, "My paintings are my diaries."
Edvard Munch comes across as somebody who's both very troubled and also very driven. He leads a really kind of odd life, basically obsessed with painting and taking breaks now and then to carouse and drink and hang out. But he seemed to have a keen mind for publicity. I'm thinking of the Berlin show, his big break in 1892. He has this show. It's so controversial, it's taken down. But he doesn't seem to care because he knows it's going to bring him publicity. Were you surprised to see that there's these different sides to Munch?
Yes, I was actually, because in Norway that he's been very romanticized, like he existed in a vacuum and he was this haunted genius who never made any bucks and just was devoted to his art. But actually he was quite an entrepreneur and had a plotting and scheming for his career and to make money and stuff like that. I'm not saying that he was commercial or something. He was quite uncompromising, but he always had a general plan. When they took down the exhibition, he said that that's the best thing that could ever happen. That's the best publicity you can get. So now I'm famous in Berlin. And he was right.
You also seem to think that Munch had a sense of humor. What's the evidence?
Oh, that's numerous of his friends and also his letters. And he sent postcards to a lot of his friends with the photographs that there where he drew cartoons of himself and made lots of jokes and funny stuff. So sometimes the humor was quite dark, but other times it was just him and his dogs and stuff like that. So there's no doubt about it. But that's been subdued in Norway because it doesn't fit with his gloominess and his angst.
What do you think The Scream or the series of paintings that make up The Scream is really about? It's such an iconic image from art.
I think one of the most important things about it is that it's very enigmatic. So every viewer can make his own or her own interpretation of it. Of course, it's very unpleasant, the emotion that the person there is experiencing. It's not a scream of joy, to say the least. So it has something to do with anxiety. If it's terror or if it's anxiety coming from within or if it's, it seems like panic angst actually, but that's pure speculations. But it doesn't seem like it's a very pleasant feeling he's expressing, to say the least.
Was Munch appreciated and celebrated in his time, or was it only after he had died that he really got the respect that he deserved?
No, he was actually regarded as the genius of his generation from a very early stage. That's another thing that's been very under-communicated in the myth about Edvard Munch. Of course, he didn't become rich until in his 40s or 50s, but that's quite normal for an artist, actually. So
he died in 1944. That was well into World War II, you know, a year from the end of it. I know he was an older man then, but did he sort of have anything to say about it? I mean, Norway was under occupation. Was he co-opted by the Nazis? What was his stance during the war?
The German Nazis in Germany, they had a lot of his paintings in the museums there, and they called it decayed art, so they banned it. But in Norway, the Nazis wanted to make him, because he was so famous and so huge in Norway, so they wanted to make him like a front man, like their genius painter. But he, of course, was totally dismissing them.
Do Norwegians celebrate Munch and are they proud of him, or do they feel like it gives a sense that Norway is full of depressed people?
Norway is probably full of depressed or at least smug people because we have the oil money, but it seems that like it's quite unanimous that Norway is proud of him, very proud. Everybody wants a piece of him, so he's huge in Norway, actually.
He's on a banknote and he's on a stamp, isn't he?
Yes, he has been several times, actually. Strange thing is that there's no streets named after him. Not one, not a single one. that's weird.
Stefan Kammerland's latest graphic novel is called Munch, about the Norwegian artist Edvard Munch. Thanks, Stefan.
Thank you.
You can see images from Stefan Kammerland's graphic biography of Edvard Munch. He draws Munch with a very pronounced chin, by the way. That's all at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.